Hello, this is UU Tor Phillips, and you are listening to Loafer's Glory, the Hobo Jungle of the Mind. At the bottom of the heart of every human being, from earliest infancy until the tomb, there is something that goes on indomitably, expecting in the teeth of all experience of crimes committed, suffered, and witnessed, that good and not evil will be done to you. It is above all that is sacred in every human being. Yes, this is Utah Phillips here in the studios of KVMR, Community Radio, Nevada City, California. That was the Borzois we were listening to, as usual. The little poem there was by Simon Weil. Well, we've all just been through an awful calamity in New York, Washington, Pittsburgh. I don't feel like being glib or funny. I feel like sorting out my feelings. Permit me to start with this reflection. I look at the horror of this past week and wait for some spark of revelation, an inspiration that brings all the pieces together. All I get are questions, and the answers are a long time coming. So much blood, so much hatred, so much need for retribution, for revenge. We all mourn. We mourn the living souls who perished in these infernos. We mourn the souls who made them. And so, it is war. Shattered buildings, shattered bodies, shattered lives. Those who did this are waging war against the innocent. But, you say, we've done that again and again all around the world, and now we reap the whirlwind. No. Wrongdoing on our part does not deposit moral currency in their account to be spent against us until we're both even. There is no more moral credibility in this act than there is in daily bombing attacks on Iraq. Both sides are wrong. Both sides believe and act upon the belief that the only response to violence is more violence, more punishment. You hurt us, we'll hurt you back. Where does this constant cycle of retaliation end? Does it ever end? Listen, there are a lot of people out there who are seriously angry with us, whose hatred, real, passionate hatred, leads to calamities like the one we're going through now. Isn't it time, way past time, that we begin to ask the question, why are you so angry? What is the source, the real bedrock source of your rage? Now, it's not up to you or me to jump in there and say, well, look what we did and look what we've done here or over there. No. The people who experience this anger define it. The deep, abiding hatred directed against the United States can only be explained by those who possess it. So we need to stop making pronouncements, threats, all of it, left, center, right, and start asking real questions. And then we can begin to adjust our behavior to the answers and end this constant cycle of revenge. We must all remember, force is the weapon of the weak. No matter who uses it. Wouldn't the memories of those who perished be better served by lending them to some purpose greater than just more death? We need to organize ourselves to that end. We are down here on the bottom. It's time to get the bottom moving the top instead of the other way around. I was happy to get all of that off of my chest. You know, a dozen years ago, I put together a body of material. Old Robert Service poems from the First World War, poems about war and peace, songs about war and peace, poems by Chesterton, Sarah Teasdale, and others, along with songs I made up over the past 40 years. Mostly I raise questions coming out of Woody's old song, I've Got to Know. Now, I'm not talking here about anyone's side. I'm talking about all of us. Let's start.
I've always been fascinated with the Spanish Civil War, the war against Franco and the fascists, the opening volley of the Second World War. And I think the reason for that was that some of my earliest recollections when I was a little kid is hearing my parents talk, sometimes very loudly, about that war. That was my first war news. Then, of course, the whole Second World War. The war news was in the newsreels. Bataan, Corregidor, Wake Island, all the movies that we saw. My grandfather, Simon Bialobjewski Cohen, my step-grandfather, a Polish-Russian Jew, bent forward with his ear pressed against a cloth on the front of the old radio, listening for war news from Europe. Then, of course, the war news in Korea. Listened to it, and then I had the opportunity to send some home myself, all the way up through Vietnam, the Gulf, all the little wars in between. Folks, I have spent my whole life listening to war news. Listening to war news. Now, there's got to be a better way to go about doing these things. I do not want to spend the rest of my life listening to war news. How about you? And I refuse to believe that this violence is a genetic predisposition, that this is just the way we are. That is a hopeless position, and I refuse to live without hope. There's a song I was gifted with from a hill-crazed Mississippi poet and carpenter, and the last of the true Shakers. When I was a young man, my father said to me, "Son, when you come of age, a carpenter you'll be." So when I come of age, I run away from home, saying, "Father, I must lay down your hammer and your nails for the tools of my own. Now I live in the forest where the wild deer run, and I never give a thought to my father's home." When I was a young man, my father said to me, "Son, when you come of age, a soldier you will be." So when I come of age, I run away from home, saying, "Father, I must lay down your sword and your gun for the weapons of my own. Now I live in the forest where the wild deer run, and I never give a thought to my father's home." Well, now there is a young man who calls himself my son. He'll step up and ask me, "Daddy, show me the way you come." And so I made this little song so I can plainly see that I don't look like a goddamn fool when he walks away from me. To live in the forest where the wild deer run and never give a thought to his father's home. Last time I flew was to Chicago, and it was better than most. Not that the food had improved or that I felt any safer. But I was sitting on the aisle, and across the aisle from me was an older woman, quite an old woman, a nun, wearing a black and gray nun's habit and a big wooden cross around her neck, and she was reading the Sojourner's magazine. Some of you must know that magazine. Meanwhile, the two young bravos sitting next to me, with their short hair, were on their way to Kentucky for basic training in the Army. Ha! A situation fraught with possibilities. Well, now, age has its privileges, so she got first crack at it. And she, in an elegant but a stern way, called those young fellows to task for their rather primitive notion of Christianity. I never had any other notion myself. Then it got to be my turn, and of course I couldn't take them to task for enlisting, because I enlisted. I enlisted in the Army and then got pipelined to Korea, the land of morning calm. I told them the same thing I told my son Duncan when he came up to Spokane coming out of high school. He was thinking of joining the Marines on the buddy system, which he did. I told him the same thing that I told him. We sat out under my lilac hedge in the backyard, and I talked to him. I said, "You know, the only thing I really learned in Korea was that I will never again abdicate to somebody else my right and my ability to decide who the enemy is. Might be I wouldn't have to go thousands of miles to find him either, and that's a fact." And this from Bertolt Brecht. "General, your tank is a powerful vehicle. It smashes down forests and crushes 100 men, but it has one defect. It needs a driver. General, your bomber is powerful. It flies faster than a storm and carries much more than an elephant, but it has one defect. It needs a mechanic. General, man is very useful. He can fly and he can kill, but
but he has one defect. He can think.
Why do your warships sail on my waters? Why do your death bombs fall from my sky? Why do you burn my farm and my town down? I've got to know, friend, I've got to know why. What makes your ships haul death to my people? Nitro blockbusters, big cannons and guns. Why can't your ship bring food and some clothing? I've got to know, yes, I've got to know why. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know, friend. Hungry lips ask me wherever I go. Comrades and friends all falling around me. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know. What good work did you do? I'd like to ask you to give you my money right out of my hands. I built your big house to hide from my people. Why do you hide so? I've got to know. Why can't we spend more to build homeless shelters? Why are the homeless here anyhow? Fortunes are building on greed and on killing. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know now. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know, friend. Hungry lips ask me wherever I go. Comrades and friends all falling around me. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know. You keep me in jail, you lock me in prison. Your hospital's jammed and your crazy house full. What made your cop hurt my unarmed peace worker? I've got to know, yes, I've got to know why. My friends are dying from AIDS and from cancer. The big money goes where your death missiles fly. Built by good workers, paid by war taxes. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know why. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know, friend. Hungry lips ask me wherever I go. Comrades and friends all falling around me. I've got to know, yes, I've got to know.
Many years ago, I was a soldier in Korea. One night in Seoul City, the Korean capital, I found myself walking toward the Ewha Women's University. There, in the bombed-out auditorium, I was going to listen to the great African-American opera singer, Marian Anderson. As I was walking, I recalled how hard it was for Marian Anderson to get a hotel room in Salt Lake City when she came there to sing in my father's theater. I wrote this poem that night, walking through the streets. Standing in the alleys of Yongsan, I wonder if Pyongyang looks the same. Everything broken, endless mud, children searching for someone. Tomorrow the looking will end and the begging will begin. Soldiers move briskly, confidently among the ruins of what we have done to each other. We did it, not because we wanted to, but because we were told to. Well, it's done now. Tomorrow I'll go home to where the tellers are. If there's any purpose to what I've done here, it is the certainty that I will never again do what I am told. Down inside the packing houses, there is a Judas ram. Leads the sheep into the slaughter and goes free to lead again. We are only sheep who follow. We are nothing more than slaves. While the leaders make decisions that will lead us to our graves. You can say I am mistaken. You can tell me I am blind. I don't want your war and killing. I will never change my mind. I can't let your television take away my sight. I can't let your yellow ribbon strangle what is right. Don't sell your labor to the death mills that these warlords profit from. Don't bear arms against each other. Save us from the Judas ram. I got back from Korea. I was so tied down tight about what I'd seen and done, I didn't know if I could ever live in the country again. I just rode the freight trains for a couple of years, drunk most of the time. I fetched up in the Roper yards of the Denver Rio Grande and Western Railroad. I had come back to Salt Lake, my home. There was a house down by the Roper yards called the Joe Hill House, started by Ammon Hennessy, one of the Catholic workers, one of Dorothy Day's people, the Catholic worker movement from the Great Depression. Ammon Hennessy. Wiry little guy, I met him in his 69th year. Ammon was a Catholic, anarchist, pacifist, vegetarian, draft dodger in two world wars, tax refuser, one-man revolution in America. I think that about covers it. Right off, he said, you know, you love the country. You come into town with these beautiful songs about marvelous people and places you've been. You know you love the country. You just can't stand the government. Now get it straight. He quoted Mark Twain, loyalty to the country always, loyalty to the government when it deserves it, an essential distinction I had been neglecting. And then he had to deal with my violence, my capacity for violence. I was violent in a lot of different ways, a lot of violent emotions and a lot of violent behavior. But he had to deal with that with everybody in the house, and he never called the cops. He was an anarchist. He dealt with everything right there by himself, besides which if you're always calling the cops, nobody would use the place. He reached out and embraced that violence. He said, you've got to be a pacifist. I said, what's that? He said, well, I can't give you a book like about Gandhi. I can't give you a list of things, of principles, that if you sign it and subscribe to it, boom, you're a pacifist. He said, it's kind of like being an alcoholic. Eventually, if the booze isn't going to kill you, you got to be able to acknowledge you're an alcoholic and then sit in a circle of people that are like that and put your hand up in the air and say, my name is Bruce, I'm an alcoholic. And then to begin to deal with the alcoholic behavior, have it described to you and deal with it. And it's never going to change. You could be dry for 20 years and you're still going to be an alcoholic, but it's going to save your life. And you're all going to be fighting against that next drink every day of your life. That's the same with a pacifist. You got to be able to do the same thing. Put your hand in the air and say, I acknowledge my capacity for violence. And then you're going to deal with that violent behavior every minute in every situation, every day for the rest of your life. But it'll save your life. So I said, okay, I'll try that. Ammon said, it's not enough. I said, oh. And said, you know, you were born a white man in mid-20th century industrial society. You came into the world armed to the teeth with an arsenal of weapons, the weapons of privilege, sexual privilege, racial privilege, economic privilege. You want to be a pacifist. It's not just giving up your hard, angry thoughts. It's not just giving up guns and knives and fists and clubs. You're going to have to give up the weapons of privilege and go forth into the world completely disarmed. That's hard. Ammon's been gone 20 years, and I'm still at it. But if there's a worthy struggle in my life, I suppose that's the one. Now, I'd always wanted to make a song for Ammon Hennessy. Not about him. I don't think he would have wanted one. But something mulched up out of his thought. An anarchist song. Ammon once told old Judge Ritter, when he was taken to jail for picketing illegally, he did a lot of that, he never pled innocent or guilty. He pled anarchy. And Judge Ritter would say, "Hell, what's an anarchist?" And Ammon would say, in his quiet way, "Why, an anarchist is anybody who doesn't need a cop to tell him what to do. Sort of a fundamentalist anarchist." Well, listening to him and watching him, I learned that anarchy is not a noun. It's an adjective. And it describes the tension between moral autonomy and political authority, especially in the area of combinations, whether they are to be voluntary or coercive. The most coercive combinations are those formed through force. But you see, force is the weapon of the weak. The new ruling party is holding the aces. The rest of the cards are all missing faces. I'm sorry I can't know you today. What can one say? I will not obey. Give us your sons and give us your daughters. No one is safe or immune from the slaughter. How indifference makes them rage. What can one say? I will not obey. National Guard or freedom fighters, all houses belong to cigarette lighters. But who hides in the smoke? What can one say? I will not obey. Better perhaps to perish outside of the bunkers where our generals hide. I turn away and spit. What can one say? I will not obey. Give us the minds of your children to learn the substance of books we have not yet burned. But can they read the sky for rain? What can one say? I will not obey. Soon all tyrants will feel our impatience. We choose to create our own combinations. I was always willing to agree. What can one say? I will not obey. The essence of contract is agreement, not coercion or obedience. And agreement is sacred. What can one say? I will not obey. There are so few wars of people's liberation, for the people have so seldom risen. Only the armed faction, listen, the armed faction lies. They recreate the state through their action. When the people rise, it is not they, but the state which dies. I sing this song for the prisoners' release, most of all now for the new state police. You see, the guns have changed hands. Again, what can one say? I will not obey. And now, The Wife of Flanders by G.K. Chesterton, written during the First World War, 1916. Low and brown barns, thatched and repatched and tattered, where I had seven sons until today. A little hill of hay your spur has scattered. This is not Paris. You have lost the way. You, staring at your sword to find it brittle, surprised at the surprise that was your plan, who, shaking and breaking barriers not a little, find nevermore the death door of Sedan. Must I for more than carnage call you claimant, paying you a penny for each son you slay? Man, the whole globe in gold were no repayment for what you have lost. And how shall I repay? What is the price of that red spark that caught me from a kind farm that never had a name? What is the price of that dead man they brought me? for other dead men do not look the same. How should I pay for one poor graven steeple whereon you shattered what you shall not know? How should I pay you, miserable people? How should I pay you everything you owe? Unhappy, can I give back your honor? Though I forgave, would any man forget? While all the green land has trampled on her the treason and terror of the night we met. Not any more in vengeance or in pardon an old wife bargains for a bean that's hers. You have no word to break, no heart to harden. Ride on and prosper. You have lost your spurs. I spend a lot of time these days going to demonstrations and vigils, talking to people who support the war. It can be pretty threatening, but I always find there are people there, and I don't mean policemen, but there are people there who will protect you. I don't go there to shout or to lecture, but to ask questions, real questions, questions I really need answers to. When I joined the Army, it was kind of like somebody that I had been brought up to respect, wearing a suit and a tie, maybe a little older, in my neighborhood. Think about yourself in your neighborhood and this happening to you. He walked up to me, put his arm around my shoulder, and said, "See that fellow on the corner there? He's really evil and has got to be killed. Now, you trust me, you'll go do it for me, won't you? The reasons are a little complicated, but I won't bother to explain, but you go and do it for me, will you?" Well, if somebody did that to you in your neighborhood, you'd think it was foolish. You wouldn't do it. Well, what makes it more reasonable to do it on the other side of the world? That's one question. Well, now hook it into this. If I was to go down into the middle of your town and bomb a house and then shoot the people coming out in flames, the newspapers would say, "Homicidal maniac." The cops would come and they'd drag me away. They'd say, "You're responsible for that." The judge would say, "You're responsible for that." The jury would say, "You're responsible for that." And they would give me the hot squad or they'd put me away for years and years and years, you see? But now exactly the same behavior, sanctioned by the state, could get me a medal and elected to Congress. Exactly the same behavior. I want the people I'm talking to reconcile that contradiction for themselves and for me. The third question, well, I take that one a lot to peace people. There's a lot of moral ambiguity going on around here. Peace people who say, "Well, we got to support the troops." And they wear the yellow ribbon and wrap themselves in the flag. Say, "We don't want what happened to the Vietnam vets to happen to these vets when they come home. People getting spit on." Well, I think it's terrible to spit on anybody. I think that's a consummate act of violence. And it's a terrible mistake, and I'm really sorry that happened. But what did happen? Son Mai happened. My Lai happened. The defoliation of a country happened. Tons of pesticides happened. 30,000 MIAs in Vietnam happened. And it unhinged some people, made them real mad. And what really, really made them mad was the denial of personal responsibility, saying, "I was made to do it. I was told to do it. I was doing my duty. I was serving my country." Well, we've already talked about that. Now, it is morally ambiguous to wrap yourself in the flag and wear those ribbons. And it borders on moral cowardice. I don't mean to sound stern. Well, yes, I do. But what does the Nuremberg Declaration say? There's no superior order that can cancel your conscience. Nations will be judged by the standard of the individual. Look, the president makes choices. The Congress makes choices. The Chief of Staff makes choices. The officers make choices. All those choices percolate down to the individual trooper with his finger on the trigger, the individual pilot with his thumb on the button that drops the bomb. If that trigger doesn't get pulled, if that button doesn't get pushed, all those other choices vanish as though they never were. They're meaningless. So what is the critical choice? What is the one that we've got to think about and get to? And friends, if that trigger gets pulled, if that button gets pushed and that bomb falls, and you say, "I support the troops," you're an accomplice. I don't want to be accomplice, do you? And I don't want to dehumanize anyone. I don't want to take away anybody's humanity. Humans are able to make moral decisions, moral ethical decisions. When we tell the trooper who pulls the trigger or the soldier who turns the wheel that releases oil into the Persian Gulf that they're not responsible, just following orders, just doing their duty, have no choice, bypassing them, making them a part of the machine, we deny them their humanity, their responsibility for their actions and the consequences of those actions. Look, I've been a soldier. I don't want any moral loophole. I need to take personal responsibility for my actions. And if we don't learn how to do this, we're going to keep on going to war again and again and again. Well, a final question. When I'm at these war support demonstrations, the question I ask most is, you think that people on the other side of the world need to be killed on the strength of voices coming out of a box? Sounds pretty silly when you put it that way, doesn't it? I want to know from the person standing in front of me, what part of you is responding to those voices? Can you tell me? What makes you feel that way? Who in you are those voices talking to? Who's really answering, and why? I hear those voices. I have those feelings. The violence is in me, too. Hello, young Jones, with your tie sagay and your pen behind your ear. Will you mark my check in the usual way, for I'm overdrawn, I fear? Then you look at me in a manner bland as you turn your ledger leaves, and you hand it back with a soft white hand and the air of a man who grieves. Was it you, young Jones, was it you I saw, and I think I see you yet, with a live bomb gripped in your grimy paw and your face to the parapet, with your lips a snarl and your eyes gone mad with a fury that thrilled you through? Oh, I look at you now and I think, my lad, was it you, young Jones? Was it you? Hello, young Smith, with your well-fed look and your coat of dapper fit. Will you recommend me a decent book with nothing of war in it? Then you smile as you polish a fingernail and your eyes serenely roam, and you suavely hand me a thrilling tale by a man who stayed at home. Was it you, young Smith, was it you I saw in the battle's storm and stench, where the roar of rage and a wound red raw leap into the reeking trench? As you stood like a fiend on the firing shelf and you stabbed and hacked and slew, oh, I look at you and ask myself, was it you, young Smith, was it you? Hello, old Brown, with your ruddy cheeks and your tummy's rounded swell. Your garden's looking jolly chic and your kitty's awfully well. Then you beam at me in your cheery way as you swing your water can and you mop your brow and you blithely say, what about golf, old man? Was it you, old Brown, was it you I saw like a bulldog stick to your gun, a cursing devil of fang and claw when the rest were on the run? Your eyes aflame with the battle hate as you sit in the family pew and see you rising to pass the plate. And I ask, old Brown, was it you? Was it me and you? Was it you and me, is that grammar, is it not, who groveled in filth and misery, who glorified and groused and fought? Which is the wrong and which is the right? Which is the false and the true? The man of peace or the man of fight? Which is the me and the you? Alessandro has said he will run to the store to bring back tobacco and beer. In silence we wait for the sound of the door. The hour of curfew is near. Outside I can hear the rattle of guns, the rumble of trucks in the street. Our lullaby ends, the dark hour comes, we whisper the small ones to sleep. Our lullaby ends, the dark hour comes, we whisper the small ones to sleep. In the morning I seek out the neighbors around, I ask them but nobody knows. Did he stop for the night with friends in the town? The doors of our friends are all closed. The sergeant looks up at the sound of my name. Quickly his eyes turn away. No need to answer, it's always the same. On the edge of the town he will say. No need to answer, it's always the same. On the edge of the town he will say. Like a broken toy, he lies in the dirt and greets me with unblinking eyes. A blood-red rose has bloomed on his shirt. He sleeps to the music of flies. Lost in his silence, thoughtless, I wait for an angel of Christ to appear. My heart is closed in the black hand of hate, and hatred has stolen my tears. My heart is closed in the black hand of hate. Hatred has stolen my tears. A bullet will open such a small wound when our children are led to the wall. The price of his life was the sun and the moon. The price of his death was so small. And where are the bullets to buy back the dreams of children who never grow old? And why have you traded our rice and our beans for coffee more precious than gold? And why have you traded our rice and our beans for coffee more precious than gold? I will return to the sergeant again, in my manner no trace of surprise. He will look up at the sound of my name to discover his death in my eyes. My brothers and sisters all flee to the wild to counsel, to nurture, and learn. And you who feast on the blood of a child, sleep well until we return. And you who feast on the blood of a child, sleep well until we return. Now here's Yellow Legs and Pugs, printed originally in Solidarity magazine at the beginning of the First World War, May 5th, 1917. If soldiers all were pugilists, there would not be a war. For pugilists would want to know what they were fighting for. For instance, if Tommy Atkins had been told to beat up Herman Schmitz, and Herman had been told to blow the other into bits, and if they had been pugilists, they would have answered, "No, we will not fight unless we get a section of the dough. We will not risk our arms and legs and shed our ruddy gore while you who fatten on the fight make millions by the score. Although it's a noble stunt to redden hill and dale, we will not fight unless we get a portion of the kale." And thus the worldwide warfare would be ended in a minute, for bankers would not start wars if there were nothing in it. Ain't it fine to have our little babes around us? Our old TV and our coffee pot, and all of the other things we've got, all safe and alone, with no one there to hound us. New shingle roof, no little rain can drown us. We've never seen a lawn so green, and we cut it off with a big machine, and that's all right. Our yard and fence surround us. Ain't it fine to have so much to hang on to? They cash our checks at the grocery store. We don't have to know who lives next door. We don't have to think if we don't want to. Ain't it fine to know our country is the best? Though other people may think and read, we know that all we really need is the Bible and the Reader's Digest. Look outside. somebody's bombs are falling. And as they bend and break the sky, we haven't time to wonder why. The last thing we hear, our little babes are calling. Ain't it fine to have our little babes around us? Our old TV and our coffee pot and all of the other things we've got all safe and alone, with no one there to hound us. I was working at the Joe Hill House with the same Ammon Hennessy I've been talking about. One Hiroshima memorial, it was in the mid-60s. Some of the local people decided to put in a peace garden, and everybody was asked to come in the morning and bring a plant to plant there. Well, Ammon showed up. He was a real magnet for cameras and reporters. He was carrying a cactus. One of the reporters said, "Mr. Hennessy, what have you there?" And Ammon said, "Well, it's a Harry Truman cactus." "And what is that?" The reporter said, "Well, look, it's got little pricks all over it." Now, Ammon said to me, "You know, you make up songs around the Joe Hill House about cowboys and about trains. I want you to make up something that makes sense. You go out and walk around the block, and when you get back to this memorial, you're going to sing that song." Well, I wandered off, consternated, wondered what I was going to do. I thought back to when I was a boy in Dayton, Ohio, there by Wright-Patterson Army Air Corps base where my stepfather was stationed. The airplanes used to take off low, and they'd fly over our playground. And we'd look up and drop our ball and drop our bat and wave at them. And if the pilot was looking down, he'd dip a wing to you. Made you feel like King Turd, have a whole airplane dip its wing to you. Well, years later, in, 47, we moved out to Salt Lake. And that's where I heard about the Enola Gay that was stationed out at Wendover, Utah, and it used to do its dummy bomb runs over Salt Lake City. It was flown by Colonel Claude Tibbetts, who had named the airplane for his mother. But I wondered if the kids in Salt Lake, the same time I was down there in Dayton, when they saw the Enola Gay fly over, if they would jump up and down and wave their hand, and if that plane would dip its wing. Of course, the Enola Gay took off for Tinian Island in the Marianas, and then that awful day it bombed Hiroshima with the first atomic bomb. And let's all remember this. Let's all remember this. That overseas right now, there are 1,000 nuclear weapons pointed right at Iraq, and there's only one country on Earth that has ever proven everlastingly that it's willing to use one. So who's afraid of who?
Look out, from your schoolroom window. Look up, young children, from your play. Don't wave your hand at the shining airplane. Such a beautiful sight is Enola Gay. It's many a mile from the Utah desert to Tinian Island far away. A standing guard by the barbed wire fences that hide the secret of Enola Gay. High above the clouds, in the sunlit silence, so peaceful here, I'd like to stay. There's many a pilot who would swap his pension for a chance to fly Enola Gay. What is that sound high above my city? I rush outside and search the sky. Now we are running to find the shelters. The air raid sirens start to cry. What will I say when my children ask me, where was I flying upon that day? With trembling voice, I gave the order to the bombardier of Enola Gay. Look out, from your schoolroom window. Look up, young children, from your play. Your bright young eyes will turn to ashes in the blinding light of Enola Gay. I turned to see the fireball rising. My God, all I can say, I hear a voice within me crying. My mother's name was Nola Gay. Look out, from your schoolroom window. Look up, young children, from your play. Oh, when you see the warplanes flying, each one is named Enola Gay.
There's something in your face, Michael. I've seen it all the day. There's something square that wasn't there when first you went away. It's just the army life, Mother, the drill, the left and right, that puts the stiffening in your spine and locks your jaw up tight. There's something in your eyes, Michael, and how they stare and stare. You're looking at me now, boy, as if I wasn't there. It's just the things I've seen, Mother, the sights that come and come, a bit of broken, bloody pulp that used to be a chum. There's something in your heart, Michael, that makes you wake at night, and often when I hear you moan, I tremble in my fright. It's just a man I killed, Mother. A mother's son like me. It seems he's always haunting me. He'll never let me be. But maybe he was bad, Michael. Maybe it was right to kill the enemy I hate in fair and honest fight. I did not hate at all, Mother. He never did me harm. I think he was a lad like me who worked upon a farm. And what's it all about, Michael? Why did you have to go, a quiet, peaceful lad like you, and we were happy so? It's them up above, Mother. It's them that sits and rules. We've got to fight the wars they make. It's us as are the fools. And when will it end, Michael? And what's the use, I say, of fighting if whoever wins? It's us that's got to pay. Oh, it will be the end, Mother, when lads like him and me, that sweat to feed the ones above, decide that we'll be free. And when will that day come, Michael? And when will fightin' cease, and simple folks may till their soil and live in love and peace? It's coming soon and soon, Mother, it's nearer every day, when only those who work and sweat will have a word to say, when all who earn their honest bread in every land and soil will claim the fellowship of all, the comradeship of toil. When we, the workers, all demand, what are we fighting for? Then, we'll end that stupid crime, that devil's madness, war.
I've traveled round the country, and I'll tell you what I've seen. A million yellow ribbons, and I've wondered what they mean. It's love and hope and sympathy for those who've gone to fight. Still I know that none of these can make the killing right. When we see two children fighting, don't we try to come between? We get them both to talk instead of acting rough and mean. We give them love and limits, say, now try to get along. Then we tell them it's all right to kill, to prove that killing's wrong. Sometimes that yellow ribbon tries to make me feel ashamed. It tells me I'm a traitor, that somehow it's me to blame. But I can't hide behind it just to prove that I belong. And I won't be an accomplice to things I know are wrong. But I'd wear a yellow ribbon for the peace that's in my heart. I'd wear it for the loved ones who should never have to part. I'd wear it for the wasted lives, no matter friend or foe. And I'd wear it for the children if they never had to go. Yes, I've seen the yellow ribbons hanging up all over town, but I don't think they'll ever buy the peace we've never found. The guns will all be silent and the battle flags all furled when we tie a yellow ribbon round the world. The guns will all be silent and the battle flags all furled when we tie a yellow ribbon round the world.
It's Saudi duty time. Stop that. Hey, want something positive you can do in your own life to work for peace? Take a little time out. Search around in your body, in your muscles, in your flesh for all of the sore points, all the small pains, all of the tie-ups. Wad them up together. Shop around in your spirit. Shop around in your heart for all of your fears, your anxieties, your rages. Reach into your mind and take out all of those ugly, deformed images that are poured in day and night. And all of those exploitive sexual images that are used to sell products. Wad all of that up into one tight ball down in your middle. And in one final act of violence, pick up your television set and throw it out the front window. Then you can learn to live in peace with each other. The fellow came from New York City to work with Ammon Hennessy at the Joe Hill House. His name was Murphy Dowie. Murph, or the Cajun, we called him. He was from Pointe-aux-Chiens, the dogleg in Louisiana. A young pacifist, Catholic anarchist like Ammon was. Well, he worked at the Joe Hill House around 1964, made up a lot of good songs. And then he was picked up by the feds and thrown into Thiegelville Federal Penitentiary as a CO. Lost track of him. I sure wish I knew where he was, but this is one of his songs. It rolls on and on, this mighty river, a rolling onward to the sea, then up into the sky in vapor, and down in rain on you and me. I see a face in this here river, a smiling up for all to see. It's not my face I see reflected, it's all of you and me. It rolls on and on, this mighty river, a rolling onward to the sea, then up into the sky in vapor, and down in rain on you and me. I hear a voice in this here river, a calling out both loud and clear. And the voice I hear in this here river, it's the voice of my people far and near. It rolls on and on, this mighty river, a rolling onward to the sea, then up into the sky in vapor, and down in rain on you and me. Well, love is just like a mighty river, flowing onward on its way. Don't try to dam its course around us, but ride upon its waves each day. It rolls on and on, this mighty river, rolling onward to the sea, then up into the sky in vapor, and down in rain on you and me. There shall come soft rains, and the smell of ground, and swallows circling with their shimmering sound. Frogs will sing in the pools at night, and wild plum trees in tremulous white. Robins will wear their feathery fire, whistling their whims on a low fence wire. And not one will know of the war, not one will care at last when it is done. Not one would mind neither earth nor tree if mankind perished utterly. And spring herself, when she awoke at dawn, would scarcely know that we were gone. Thanks for sticking with me through this one. My name is UU Taw Phillips, and you're listening to Loafer's Glory, the Hobo Jungle of the Mind. If you believe in peace,
You must find it first in your own soul. If you believe in peace, you must learn to live it now, where you are. Peace begins with you.